of the fusion of nationalism and religion. There's the constant invocations of God by the politicians, there's the emphasis on God in the Pledge of Allegiance, it's on the coins or the currency and so on. And so this is the Old Testament war god, mostly concerned with law and order, really. And America, of course, is the chosen people. People just feel better when they think that God blesses America. And then they can identify with a strong military. God is obviously on our side, despite the fact that it's obvious that the military-industrial complex has no interest in ordinary people except as cannon fodder. Have I upset you?
War as death?
What do you mean? Sorry.
You can't have war without death. Isn't it something about that too?
Yes, of course. But I'm not sure. Of course you can't have war without death. Do you want me to talk about death? Is that... Oh, okay. But I think you're actually pointing to something very important, which is the glorification of death. Yes, I think that is actually a very important point. Very important point. Well, I was going to say that loyalty to the country is a way of being part of something larger than oneself, and that's a transcendent feeling and a spiritual feeling. But I don't think we should be judgmental about this phenomenon. I think we should see it as a mechanism that people use to hold themselves together and reassure themselves and comfort themselves when they're frightened that they're under attack. It's very important to be empathic about that and not be judgmental about it. It's a way of restoring one's sense of self-importance and prevent feelings of isolation when one is in danger. So let's just say that that's the psychological understanding and not be judgmental about it. The worst thing we can do about this is be judgmental about it. So I'm suggesting that the passions of war at one level are spiritual passions. And then when these passions are stirred up, the enemy becomes the heathen. And the extreme example, of course, is the religion of Nazism. At its spiritual level, and it was a spiritual movement, was hostile to Christianity. Nazism had its faith, its prophet, its canon of literature, it had its hierarchy, its mythological images of that invoked ancient German pagan imagery, and ritual and ceremony on a very large scale. All those flags and banners and candles and marches and so on. Some Nazis actually, in case you don't believe this, some Nazis took the Bibles and the crosses off the church altars, this is well documented, and replaced them with swastikas and copies of Mein Kampf. I have the documentation of this. People were encouraged to pray to Hitler. There was an organization called the League of German Girls that had its own version of the Lord's Prayer that invoked Hitler. Here's what they said. Thy Third Reich come, thy will alone is law upon earth. How do you like that? It was clearly a spiritual movement for them. Get rid of the idea that spirituality is all sweetness and light. It isn't. Same thing. Thank you, yes. People in Nazi Germany professed the religion of the blood. Hitler actually compared himself to a messiah. There were holy days in Nazi Germany. January the 30th was the anniversary of the day Hitler came to power, and April the 20th was his birthday. Those were holy days. So his unconscious spirituality was a spirituality of war, which is an archetypal path. There is the archetype of the warrior. The warrior archetype is a legitimate spiritual path. It has to do with the willingness to die for a greater cause. Of course, there are many ways to die, but that is an authentic spiritual path that we know from many, many cultures. And some of his biographers say that war, one of his biographers, Tolan, says that war filled him with rapturous enthusiasm. Think of the word enthusiasm, enthusios, filled with God. Suffused with God is the etymology of that word. And he described the trench one of the biographies, he said to have described the trenches of World War I as a monastery with walls of flame. These are religious sentiments. So again, we have to look at this kind of evil without condoning it and without excusing it, but at the same trying to understand it. This has always been one of the, as I said, one of the objections to psychological approaches. Hitler was severely abused as a child. From childhood to about the age of, I forget when his father died, when he was 12 or 13 or something, 14, he was beaten every day by a violent alcoholic father. Every day. According to some biographers, not all of them. There are many biographies of Hitler. He had a mother who paid very little emotional... Well, imagine being beaten every day of your life by an alcoholic, violent father, regardless of what you do. Can you imagine the level of hatred and rage that that would build up in the individual? His mother had lost two children to diphtheria before he was born, and another child died just before he was born. So she'd just lost three children. So I think probably he had a mother who didn't want to bond with him emotionally, because the death of three children would mean that it was too risky to bond emotionally with another child. So I don't think he gets much from her. He's got a rather difficult moon in Capricorn. Then he's got this violent, aggressive father. Now, is that enough to account for his behavior? You see, there are people like Emil Fackenheim says that you can't use those kind of explanations to account for Hitler. Fackenheim says only God can understand Hitler. Because if we were to plot human evil on a graph, Hitler would be off the graph. His evil is so enormous. It's sort of qualitatively different than ordinary human evil. But I don't think that's true. I think actually using a depth psychological approach, we can understand that if you're full of rage and hatred like that, one of the ways you can handle it is by evacuating it onto other people. I'll talk more about that mechanism in a little while. Saddam Hussein's childhood was also a nightmare. His mother tried to abort him by beating her abdomen. Okay. And then when he was a baby, she gave him away to an uncle who was extremely violent and beat him constantly. For a person like this, only a constant state of war makes sense, because war is going on all the time in the person's inner world. Life is a war. Life is a battle. See, I'm trying to recommend here an approach to evil based on empathy. I know it sounds odd to put those two words in the same sentence, but I mean empathy in a very specific technical sense here. I'm using it in the sense of the Chicago psychoanalyst Heinz Kohut. That's K-O-H-U-T. Sorry, K-O-H-U-T. Kohut was a Chicago psychoanalyst who wrote a great deal about the importance of empathy. And empathy, as we know, means the capacity to feel into what the other person is feeling by experiencing the same feelings that the other person is feeling, feeling into the emotional state of the other person. So that when you sit with somebody who's in pain or depressed or sad or angry or whatever, it's like two tuning forks. If you take a vibrating tuning fork and you put a still tuning fork next to it, after a while they both start to resonate with the same frequency. Well, the body is like that. Remember I said emotion is in the body. You sit with somebody who's miserable, and in a few minutes you start to feel miserable, because your body starts to resonate the same way. I mean, unless you're dense, there are people who won't let it in and so on. But in ordinary people who are not resistant to it will empathically start to feel the same way that the other person starts to feel. It's one of the most important things that happens in psychotherapy, this emotional resonance. So what one has to do is a kind of empathic experiment, imagining the kind of inner world of psychopathic personalities like Hussein or Hitler. What is their inner world like when they're so full of rage and hatred because of this constant abuse and the absence of any normal kind of affection? And is that enough? You see, if it's not enough, to account for the behavior of Hitler and Hussein and people like that. What do we fall back on? We fall back on a kind of bad seed theory, you know, Rosemary's baby. This is a child of the devil, and whatever the background is like, wouldn't make any difference, because the child of the devil is going to, it's a bad seed, it's going to go rotten, whatever the environment is like. I don't myself want to fall back on that. There are people who do. They say that's kind of the sort of an acorn theory of development. I'm not sure, you know. I think these developmental factors are very important. I'll come back to them. What happens in these kind of personalities is that the outer world, as always, reflects the inner world. So there's constant conflict and war and rage and hatred going on in the inner world. Hatred of one's persecutors, hatred of one's childhood tormentors. So one has to make the outer world like that. So only a state of continuous war makes sense. And don't think that this doesn't apply to our politicians. They just have nicer suits. But the inner world is exactly the same. You see, the way it works is that if, as a child, you were treated as prey in a merciless home, which is the fate of the antisocial psychopathic personality, subject to this kind of ruthless violence, then one way you can handle that, one way is to die. Another way is to become a predator yourself. And then when you become a predator, what you do is, instead of feeling that terrible helplessness and the torment of helpless subjugation yourself, you inflict it on other people. You evacuate those feelings of helplessness and vulnerability by making other people feel them. We evacuate onto others what we can't tolerate in ourselves. So I'm not going to be a helpless victim. I'm going to make sure that I'm strong, and I'm going to make you the helpless victim. That's this mechanism by which we inflict on other people what was done to ourselves. And I'm afraid this is a mechanism that many politicians fall into. For these people, you're either predator or prey. There's nothing in between. And so obviously it's safer to be the predator and not the prey. Okay. That, by the way, is so, one of the reasons that Hitler was so preoccupied with wolf imagery. His dog was called Wolf. The SS were called his wolf pack. He said that when he was born, a wolf was born. He wanted some people to call him Wolf and so on. He was very preoccupied with this predatory imagery. So the violent dictator makes others into helpless victims of the kind that he was as a child. I was a helpless victim as a child. Now I'm going to make you, the Jews, the Gypsies, the Slavic peoples, homosexuals, mentally ill people, any character, any groups I can find, I'll make you the helpless victims. It's the same. That's the psychology of it. I won't ever be a helpless victim again. I'll do to you what was done to me. Children who were raised in dangerous homes find the world dangerous, and they become paranoid. They're always looking for danger. And many of our politicians have this kind of paranoid tendency because they grew up in dangerous homes. And if you grew up in a dangerous home, I'll give you some examples later on, you have to have missile defense shields and all the rest of it. Because you're afraid. Because you're always expecting danger. You're always expecting attack. Now, this is not to be judgmental. I'm suggesting all these mental mechanisms as a way of empathically understanding without being judgmental. There is no point in our just judging these people in a negative kind of way. The only thing that will work will be empathy and understanding. If we retaliate, we will just make our behavior the same as theirs. So let me talk a little bit about predator anxiety, as I mentioned earlier. And this is a thing I actually got from Jung. He does have his uses, the old boy. It's very, I didn't write the quote down, I'm sorry, but it's somewhere in the collected works. Predatory animal. Oh, I'm sorry. Yes.
I completely agree with your analysis here. But one of the most frustrating things for someone like myself who's involved in political groups and so forth, yeah, is that the right wing tends to say, you're making excuses for these people.
Yes.
How do you address that? Well, you're making an excuse for Hitler.
Well, that's what I tried to do at the beginning. That's why I spent some time on that, by trying to say that to understand something is not to excuse it or condone it. That it's like a disease. You can only treat a disease if you understand the disease mechanisms. So that's how I address it. I say it's a disease of the personality or the society, if it's war or violence, and we have to understand we treat it like an illness. You don't understand tuberculosis unless you know that there's a tubercle bacillus. If you don't know there's a tubercle bacillus, you don't know why the person is coughing up blood. You know what I mean? It's like that. That's how I would address it. So what I got from this thing in Jung is that many countries have predatory creatures on their flags. The eagle is on the US flag, the German flag, the Mexican flag, the Polish flag, and the Spanish flag. The eagle is a predatory creature. The lion is on the British flag, the Finnish flag, the Kenyan flag, and the Norwegian flag. I looked this all up. The hawk is on the Egyptian flag, and the bear is on the Russian flag. At this point, I got fed up. But I found all these are predatory creatures, and they're on the flag. I mean, they don't realize what they're doing when they're waving these flags. They're waving the flag of predatorship, if that's a word, okay? So predator anxiety is a very important source of human aggression, and obviously it had its source in human prehistory. For a long time, we were the prey of, in our early hominid phase of evolution, we were the prey of predatory carnivorous animals who hunted us and killed our early ancestors. So predator anxiety had to evolve so that we could protect ourselves from predators. That's why we have it. Remember that our species has only been around for 150,000 years. They keep changing the time. Used to be 200,000. Now I hear it's 150,000. But that's just the blink of an eye. We have the same brain. So we still have that evolutionary mechanism in us of being afraid of predators. Okay. And that is thought to be the result of the cause of what's called stranger anxiety. You know, about around 9 months. Before about 9 months, babies are kind of happy to be cuddled and held by anyone. But around 9 months, they get afraid of strangers. And they only want to be held by people that they know very well. That's called stranger anxiety. And the theory is, of course, that it's dangerous to be left alone. That's why this anxiety has evolved. You need to be part of the pack to be safe, to be part of the larger group. And this contributes to abandonment anxiety and so on. So one defense against the terror of being preyed on is to do this mental mechanism that the psychoanalysts describe of what's called turning passive into active. When we, instead of being the passive victims, we turn that into becoming the active predator. And then we make other people feel our own disavowed terror, the terror of being prey. I'm going to make you feel that, and I'm going to be the predator. And that way, again, I can evacuate my own terror onto you, and I can feel better. Instead of being the one who's abused and terrified, you're going to feel that. That's called also called identification with the aggressor. Now, another way of dealing with the terror around killing and being killed is to develop a mythology of sacrifice. And I mention this because our politicians are always talking about the need for sacrifice, how our young people who are dying in war are making this sacrifice, and we talk about the supreme sacrifice and all the rest of it. So the soldiers are sacrificial victims for the sake of the country. So what is the psychology of sacrifice? You remember that the Latin sacer, S-A-C-E-R, means to make sacred. It's actually a verb. The sacrum is the sacred bone, because in traditional mythology it was thought that would be the bone from which the resurrection of the dead begins. I'm not sure exactly why that bone particularly, but that is the origin of the root of the word sacrum, the sacred bone. Anyway, so we have these sacrificial victims who are expected to die for the motherland or the fatherland or the homeland or whatever it is. Now, there are a variety of reasons that people are able to allow their children to be sacrificed in this way, and some of them are not very pleasant. One of them is the parental envy of the young. Children are massively envied. No one wants to talk about this, but I'm afraid it's true. Children are massively envied because of their innocence. One is always unpopular if one mentions the shadow. So, but I have to mention it. Children are envied because of their innocence and their beauty and because they have their life ahead of them. And then, of course, children have roles in families. Children are supposed to be the hero, the pariah, the scapegoat, or the messiah, or whatever it is for the family. All the family systems theorists talk about this. So some children are supposed to be the family's sacrificial lamb. Okay? And of course, as I mentioned yesterday, the theme of necessary sacrifice is the shadow of the Christian story, which is so much a part of Western mythology. God sacrifices his son so we can justify sacrifice of our sons, and we can justify the death penalty and so on. Now, I think that the logic of believing that wars will bring peace is the same primitive logic as the logic of sacrificing human beings to the gods, to placate the gods and to bring the good things that we need. It's sort of primitive logic. But we need to look more into this question of sacrifice, because the question of sacrifice illustrates the very important connection between violence and the sacred. There is an important connection between violence and the sacred, unless I'm wearing you out. I think I've been talking for an hour. So.
Have a stand-up break for 2 minutes.
Do you want to?
Sure. Yes.
Okay. I'm afraid this is a very depressing subject. I hope. I'm. It's my mother complex. I'm worried about oppressing you too much. Yes, I think so. Yes. Do you have a question? Here.
I think the depressing piece of it for Quakers is that even if we understand and accept what happened to Hitler, what made him the way he was, how do we address that kind of evil? Do we do it by force, Bonhoeffer tried to kill Hitler, not out of hate, but out of loving kindness, to try to keep the Jewish people and the others from being sacrificed. What do Quakers do with this kind of evil?
Well, I don't want to tell you what to do. And much as I have enormous respect for Bonhoeffer, I think he was wrong. I think Bonhoeffer was wrong. He shouldn't have tried to kill. The problem is that the consequences of violence are always unforeseeable. If that plot against Hitler would have succeeded, the generals would have run the war, and they probably would have won. Hitler had no idea what he was doing militarily, and he wouldn't let his generals run things. If Hitler would have been killed, those generals would have taken over, and they might have won the war. So who are we to say that he should have been killed? That's the problem. Let me come back to that issue. Shall I skip this whole sacrifice thing, or shall I? Okay. Okay. I'm just projecting. It's worthy, yeah. I just can't stand being bored myself, so I have. I don't want to bore you with this. Okay. So the origin of the idea of sacrifice and the relationship of violence and the sacred. And the word sacrifice means to make holy. Fakiri, to make, and saker, sacred. And so many rituals of religion all over the world involve the killing of animals or the killing of human beings as a sacrifice to the gods. And it doesn't matter where you are. India, China, South America, Africa, ancient Greece, Rome, Egypt, the temple at Jerusalem. It went on everywhere. It's clearly something archetypal. It's not found only in one place. Violence is made sacred. Horrifying thought, but it's true. In the Hebrew Bible, you see the Hebrews killing animals all the time. And the gods are fed with sacrificial animals. The gods of Olympus were supposed to enjoy the smell of the meat. And the Aztec and the Incan gods needed blood. The Hebrew God sends down his fire to consume the flesh on the altar, all that kind of stuff. What's the origin of this kind of thing? Some scholars say that religious ritual that sacrifices animals reenacts again the terror of being preyed on and attempts to master this terror by preying on the animals, by killing the animals, and then by offering them to the gods as a way of palliating the gods. If we give you this, maybe you won't kill us. Something like that would be the deal. I think this notion of trying to master anxiety and regulate it is very important. I've always been interested why people like the English, for example, are very keen on fox hunting. I think what they're doing, you know, which at first is, of course, absolutely appalling. But then if you ask why they're doing it, I think they are acting out their own fear by making the fox the hunted animal. Instead of feeling their own fear at being hunted, they project that onto this animal and they hunt the fox. It's the same kind of mechanism. And many of our movies foster predator anxiety by depicting people being eaten by animals. Think of Jurassic Park. And many of the stories that we tell children are about being eaten by wild beasts. Think of Red Riding Hood and so on. Now, it's very hard to get... These fears are implanted in childhood through fairy tales and stories, and it's hard to get rid of them because they're transmitted from generation to generation. So what happens then is that you experience predator anxiety kind of vicariously, but you survive. But the problem is that you perpetuate the anxiety. So when a terrorist attack like 9/11 happens out of the blue, we feel this atavistic predator anxiety, and so we turn this around and we become predators. Now, human sacrifice, of course, is very important. War can seem legitimate if the sacrifice seems to be in a good cause, protecting the country and all this kind of stuff. I think of war as the modern equivalent of the ritual human sacrifice that was common in antiquity. when, you know, they would sacrifice to ensure the growth of the crops, success in war, to appease the gods of the culture and this kind of stuff. So just as children were often sacrificed to the local pagan gods, we sacrifice our own young people in war. And this is a long tradition of human sacrifice. It's found in many, many cultures. You find it certainly, most of our politicians are really Old Testament believers. And in the Old Testament, Yahweh is constantly demanding that his people kill the people of other nations on his behalf. Okay. The God of the patriarchy is a war God. Remember that. For the last several thousand years of patriarchy, 3,000 or 4,000 years, whatever it's been, we've had incessant warfare ever since the God of the patriarchy appeared. Although the goddess also had her bloody aspects, there was a great deal of blood sacrificed to the Great Mother as well. I won't bore you with all the details, but the archaic mother goddess didn't just hunt animals, she also consumed the sacrificial animals. And then, of course, the God of the Christian tradition demands a human sacrifice in Jesus. So in the Christian story, Jesus is the sacrificial lamb, but also the God to whom the sacrifice is offered. One psychoanalyst, James Grotstein, suggests that God offered his son for sacrifice because God is so guilty about human suffering. And so this sacrifice is something that God makes to allow for a kind of purification of God, which I think just goes to show that psychoanalysts shouldn't try their hand at theology. He's a nice man, actually. He teaches at Pacifica. But these kind of ideas really just show us that it's easy for us to make God in our image. We are violent. God is not violent. We are violent, and we project that onto our God image, and we assume that God requires violence. That's the problem. So, and that's partly why sacrifice and violence have always been caught up with religious practices. The assumption is that God, the gods need blood. That's the assumption, which is a projection of our own human violence based on our fear and all these mechanisms that I've talked about. The projection of that fear and violence onto our God image. So there seems to be something very powerful about death and watching blood flow and so on. And in fact, in some sacrificial rituals, the victim's blood is sprinkled around to purify, in quotes, the participants. And war is often seen as having a purifying effect. It's a very common image. The enemy becomes the container into which we can project our own poison and the bad parts of ourselves. We project those onto the enemy. The extreme example, of course, is ethnic cleansing. The Nazis often spoke about what they were doing as a purification. But images of national purification are actually fairly common in war. And the blood that soldiers shed is often seen as a kind of purging. And if I have time to give you examples of that. But in 1914, there was a feeling that a bloody purging would be good for the country because the country had become degenerate because of all the material progress. Thomas Jefferson said that war is necessary to refresh the tree of liberty with the blood of patriots. Thomas Jefferson. You notice, by the way, that the Purity Crusaders, today the Purity Crusaders are against any kind of sexuality that they don't do. Are usually in favor of war. There seems to be a connection between being in favor of war and being a purity crusader. You see, the conscious fantasy of purity by violence, is actually an unconscious fantasy of getting rid of the bad parts of myself. The bad parts of me that got me into trouble, I will project onto you. I will forbid your behavior. You know, that's the origin of a great deal of homophobia and sexism and racism. The bad parts of me that I can't stand in myself, I will simply project onto you or into the enemy. This has to do with the scapegoat archetype. Girard suggested that war...